Welcome to the 16th installment of Piper Sandler's 30-Minute Market Insight Series. The goal of this conference call series is to take a holistic approach to understanding the marketplace by featuring a different sector and subject matter expert to share timely insights that influence all industries. My name is Pierce Hammond, and I am a senior research analyst with Simmons Energy, a division of Piper Sandler, and I am focused on the midstream, MLP, and infrastructure sectors. Today, I'll be discussing the following: midstream sector, key questions to ponder for the upcoming fall conference season. The call is designed to be no longer than 30 minutes, and therefore we will not have time for audience questions, although I did get a couple of audience questions emailed in that I will address. If you do have any questions following the call, please reach out to me or your Piper Simmons Energy representative. As a reminder, this call cannot be referenced in any articles, and this conversation should be considered off the record. So let's go ahead and jump into today's presentation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to highlight five key questions for investors to ask management teams, midstream management teams, during the upcoming fall conference season. We believe these questions will drive worthy conversations between investors and management teams during one-on-one meetings. The five key questions are focused in the following areas. Number one, capital allocation. Number two, consolidation. Number three, upcoming election. Number four, energy transition. And finally, number five, oil macro. So let's jump right in with capital allocation. The key question, in my view, is to ask the management teams is, what is the right capital allocation strategy moving forward in light of the significant changes impacting the sector? And when we say significant changes, what are we referring to? We're referring to COVID, we're referring to the Saudi-Russia market share war and the OPEC Plus agreement, we're referring to the energy transition, etc. And so midstream sector capital spending outlooks have changed dramatically this year due to the need to help strain balance sheets, as well as the redefined outlook for U.S. crude oil production because of the pandemic and the Saudi-Russia market share war. We believe the industry is on a multi-year downward glide path for lower CapEx, which should result in blossoming free cash flow. We project average free cash flow yields, pre-distributions, of 16% for 2021 versus the current average distribution yield of about 9% for our large cap midstream coverage universe. The industry should be in a position to fully cover distributions and CapEx within cash flow, and in some cases have excess cash flow beyond that. Now, another question pertaining to capital allocation that I think is worthy for investors to ask is, what do midstream management teams plan to do with free cash flow after distributions? Many large cap midstream companies have leverage ratios of 4+ times, and so does it make sense to reduce ample debt loads, especially since the industry is maturing and the rate of normalized growth going forward will likely be markedly restrained versus prior expansionary phases? Or are the rating agencies comfortable with 4+ times leverage, and are there better uses for surplus cash flow? Thus far, through the pandemic, high-quality midstream companies have been able to issue debt at attractive rates. As an example, investment-grade companies, not just in the midstream sector, but across the economy, year-to-date have issued about $1.4 trillion of debt, which equates to the prior record set for the entirety of 2017, and the average interest rate for this paper has been at record low yields. Or should midstream companies boost their distribution? This certainly is a sensible course for companies that were forced to cut their distributions earlier this year. But for other companies, we are not certain. Why? If a company is having trouble attracting investors with a 9% yield, especially in a world of low interest rates where the search for yield is so intense, why are they going to have success attracting investors with a 10% yield? Or should midstream companies use the excess cash flow to repurchase shares? This would probably do more to get midstream stocks moving than any other course of action. Or finally, should the midstream management teams consider using excess funds to press forward with M&A? So let's move to our second subject, which touches on what I just mentioned, M&A, which is consolidation. And the key question we think investors should ask the midstream management teams is, given the maturation of the U.S. upstream sector, is consolidation an imperative for the midstream sector? And what are your thoughts on asset divestitures? And as far as like recent M&A deals, take a look at the Chevron Noble deal or the Southwestern Montage Resources deal. In fact, I would encourage any of the listeners on today's call to check out the S-4 that was filed for the Chevron Noble transaction and the business background. It offers a fascinating glimpse into what energy management teams and board of directors are having to deal with these days related to a myriad of issues and how consolidation, you know, might be a possible solution for some of those issues. Overall, we believe the unfolding energy transition, which could be propelled at an accelerated pace should Biden be elected, places even more pressure on the need for consolidation. We also expect more upstream consolidation will place increased pressure for midstream M&A. One potential driver of upstream consolidation could be inventory depth, i.e. the need to reload inventory, especially in light of producer shifting to wider space development. And let me explain that just a little bit for those that may not understand. As a reminder, producers space wells based on what generates the greatest rate of return, which is a function of well performance and commodity price. If you space wells too far apart, you can end up leaving oil behind that will never be recovered. But if you space them too tightly, you can get communication between the wells and a degradation of well performance. That degradation can be justified in a high commodity price environment, as it can still result in a higher NPV per acre. But in a low commodity price environment, the opposite is true, and it might be more desirable to space wells further apart. Why does this matter? When wells are spaced further apart, there are less drilling locations, and a producer can eat through their inventory faster, thereby precipitating the need for M&A to reload drilling inventory. And I mention all of that simply because if producers are consolidating, I think it's going to place pressure on the midstream to consolidate. Now, an M&A wave could also potentially enhance midstream share price performance. We also expect to see asset-specific divestitures, similar to Berkshire Hathaway purchasing Dominion's natural gas transmission assets. And we think those divestitures will proliferate as these could help clean up portfolios, resulting in a more streamlined and more efficient sector. The unfortunate realities, which serve as a sticking point to kicking off an M&A wave, are cultural issues and executive change of control packages. This is the hurdle the industry needs to get over in order for needed consolidation to occur. From an asset divestiture standpoint, the midstream area with likely the greatest buyer interest is long-haul regulated pipelines with minimum volume commitments, take-or-pay arrangements, investment-grade customers, etc. We think you could see interest from infrastructure funds, which have a lower cost of capital and a lower return threshold. Recently, the Wall Street Journal published an article stating that Blackstone Group's infrastructure arm and Global Infrastructure Partners were exploring a potential deal about buying the railroad Kansas City Southern. What is interesting is that essentially the buyout funds are viewing the railroad like a pipeline, but instead of it carrying oil or natural gas or NGLs, it carries corn, wheat, and automobiles. Of note, according to the Wall Street Journal, infrastructure firms raised a record $98 billion for infrastructure investments in 2019, up nearly 70% from the prior record in 2015. So there is plenty of dry powder to make infrastructure investments. Now, in midstream, unfortunately, though, G&P or gathering and processing assets remain a four-letter word and will likely be harder to divest. Now, what about private equity-backed midstream companies? There are roughly 120 PE-backed midstream companies. Currently, some of these companies that are backed by the same PE firm are consolidating in an effort to reduce G&A and improve long-term economic viability. PE firms are interested in the midstream sector, but are likely to be very opportunistic buyers and prefer to be further downstream, for example, terminals-oriented, where there are longer-term contracts in place. So now let's move to the next subject area, which is the upcoming election. And I think the key question investors should ask management teams are, how are you game planning for a potential change in the White House and Senate in November? We expect the upcoming U.S. election to potentially drive meaningful change in the midstream sector. As of this presentation, former Vice President Joe Biden has a lead in the polls, with betting sites giving him a 60% victory probability. In light of that, what does a Biden administration mean for the midstream sector? On the negative side, that would likely make constructing new infrastructure more problematic. But to be fair, how much new infrastructure is really needed? And also, a Biden administration should provide disincentives for fossil fuel use, negatively impacting midstream volumes. But on the positive side, the inability to construct new infrastructure should make the value of existing infrastructure more valuable, as well as underpin the previously mentioned consolidation rationale that we've discussed. A Biden administration could also change tax regimes, impacting the attractiveness of remaining in MLP, or provide further incentives for the midstream companies to pursue renewable energy projects. Lastly, a Biden administration, or even a Trump administration, could make renewing a nuclear deal with Iran a foreign policy priority, resulting in Iranian oil returning to market. And we'll discuss that subject more when we touch on the oil macro in a short little while. So moving to the next subject area, which is the energy transition, and this one gets a tremendous amount of attention these days, especially in light of some recent company announcements. But the key question on the energy transition that we think investors should ask midstream management teams is, how are you positioning the company for the unfolding energy transition, and what should you be doing differently? We expect midstream companies to start pivoting toward renewables and embracing the energy transition more rapidly. While one could question the efficacy of BP's new strategic shift, it certainly signals the growing imperative of embracing the secular promise of renewables, as well as the growing challenges for the legacy conventional energy industry. For the midstream sector, low-hanging fruit could be investing in solar projects to power pipeline compressor stations. It could also mean addressing the intermittency issue with respect to renewable energy by focusing on large-scale batteries or pump storage. It might also mean repurposing some old pipelines to natural gas, given that the energy transition is focused on electrifying seemingly everything, which should provide a tailwind for natural gas demand. It could also mean starting a dialogue and giving thought to repurposing some assets to carry hydrogen. Now, admittedly, a large-scale movement to hydrogen is well into the future, but the dialogue could start now. And of note, hydrogen came up on a few Q2 midstream earnings conference calls that I thought was kind of interesting. But we have seen some interesting announcements of late, not just BP's. Yesterday, Williams announced a very serious carbon reduction goal in a press release, and I think they're one of the first major midstream companies to be that ambitious with a goal and that public with it. But you've also seen other companies, Phillips 66 on the refining side, repurposing a refinery in the San Francisco area to become a renewable diesel facility, and even oil field services companies like NOV getting involved in the wind business. And so the last subject that I'd like to address would be the oil macro. And I think the key question that investors should ask midstream companies are, what do flattish U.S. oil production volumes of approximately 11 million barrels a day and a rig count of 25% of last year's peak mean for your business over the next 12 to 24 months? Hoping to return to pre-COVID days when the industry was about keeping up with rapid U.S. oil production growth is wishful thinking. Oil demand remains stubbornly below pre-COVID levels owing to headwinds from aviation, work from home, online learning, and high unemployment. Navigating a soft landing for record shut-in production is a delicate balancing act. Furthermore, there's the potential complication of Iranian oil returning to market. Bottom line, there's ample global inventory combined with large amounts of shut-in production and embargoed oil that should keep a lid on price improvements and a consequential boost in drilling and completions activity. While oil prices have recovered from the extreme lows reached in April, they have been firmly fixed in the low 40s for the past few months. In addition, as we move out of the summer, we will lose the summer driving season gasoline demand tailwind. For midstream companies hoping to a return to yesteryear rates of expansion, there needs to be a supply disruption of some consequence from the Middle East, which renews the call for increased U.S. energy security and drives higher U.S. oil production. However, such a price signal and call for U.S. energy security would likely only accelerate the aforementioned energy transition that we've discussed. However, Simmons Energy analyst and longtime market observer Bill Herbert well stated in a recent note, quote, "The clamor of austerity emanating from Q2 earnings calls on the part of the entirety of the lower 48 upstream value chain signals a reasonably durable cessation in reinvestment, at least for now, which will have consequences to forward supply and the need for additional OPEC barrels and eventually a non-OPEC reinvestment cycle in order to fuel forward demand growth." So stay tuned on that front. And by the way, Bill published an Energy Ruminations note yesterday after the close titled Contemplating Austerity, Normalization, Stigmatization, and Reinvention, which I think is a worthy read for anyone on the call here that picks up on some of the themes that I've already discussed today. Before we leave oil and then address the two investor questions that we received via email, one oil macro sort of note and slide that has received a decent amount of investor attention comes from Enterprise Products Partners, EPD's most recent investor deck, where they do some oil forecasting, and they show U.S. oil production, the steep decline in Q2 with the shut-ins. Then the reversal is the shut-ins get turned back on. But then, given the lack of drilling activity and natural declines, that oil production by the end of the year coming back down to the level it was at Q2, that has certainly received investor attention and led to questions of us as to what that means for the rest of, you know, for the full remainder of the coverage universe. So we did get some questions that I'd like to go through that I thought were quite good. The first is, I'm curious how the industry is thinking about debt leverage given the low and perhaps persistently low interest rate environment. Are we seeing more folks lever up, i.e. increase target debt levels? And is this an opportunity or risk for the sector? And then has there been a change in the attitude of some investors, specifically private equity, due to the rate environment? And so to answer these questions, are we seeing more of the companies lever up? And the answer is no. In fact, if anything, they're wanting to go the other direction and reduce leverage. And so we've seen that with companies reducing their leverage targets. And while there has been good availability in the debt markets for the midstream companies, especially the large integrated midstream companies, you know, thus far this year, I think the management teams overall are worried about higher cost of capital for conventional energy as we move forward and what that means. Plus, there's the maturation of the sector. So I do think we're seeing, rather than folks lever up, we're seeing the opposite. And is this an opportunity or a risk for the sector? I think it's an opportunity if you bring the leverage down, especially in a maturing sector, that could be a sensible move. Now, has there been a change in the attitude of some investors due to the rate environment? No, at least from our perspective, that hasn't been a big driver, on that. And that touches on the next question, which I think is a good one, which is, at what point do solid midstream companies with lightly leveraged balance sheets and solid dividends and distributions start to attract attention from investors looking for yield in a low-rate environment? And does technology have to underperform first? And so to address that first question, as far as a huge yield spread between, say, the 10-year U.S. Treasury, which is at like 0.7% right now, or the S&P 500 yield, which is a bit below 2% right now, versus a lot of midstream, especially large integrated midstream, some of which are at like 10%, you would think that there would be more interest simply based on that spread. I've thought that, and that hadn't borne out thus far. And I think it hasn't borne out because there's worries about the energy macro, then there's worries about the whole energy transition, and then there's some worries about the structure with some of the companies being MLPs versus C-Corps. And I think the combination of those three things have kind of kept investors away. And hopefully, at some point, that arbitrage between the yields, and especially if people believe that those distributions are more sustainable and backed by ample sources of free cash flow, will start bringing some investors back in. But certainly one would expect that to happen. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened just yet. And then the follow-on question is, do technology stocks have to underperform first? And my best analogy to think about that, and you've probably seen this in TV shows or in movies, where they have the military and they line people up and they say, I need a volunteer, and everybody steps backward, and there's one person who didn't react, and they are now the volunteer, even though they didn't step forward. And I think there is some truth to that as it relates to energy investing, in the sense that, yes, if technology pull back, then energy is going to look more attractive relative to the technology companies. But when tech continues to work and continues to work, it's hard for people to move away from that and to take a look at the energy stocks. So I appreciate everybody attending today's call. A replay will be made available. Please join us next time on September 10th at 12 noon Central, as we will be hearing from Rich Repetto, a Piper Sandler senior research analyst covering financial services. We will not be hosting a call next week due to the holiday weekend. And if you do have any questions, follow-up questions at all, feel free to reach out to me or your Simmons Energy representative, and you may now disconnect. Thank you.